A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Nowdies podcast. I'm your host, James Leonard, joined by my co-host.
Hi, everyone. Timmy.
Timmy Long. Yeah, and this week is a very special guest. We have Dr. Gábor Máté, whom a lot of you would have heard of. For those of you that might not be familiar with Gábor, he's a Hungarian-born Canadian physician who has a history in family practice, but is world-renowned specialist in childhood development and trauma, and how that links to mental health issues and physical health issues. So I could have went the long way around the introduction, but in a nutshell, that's who you are. So look, thanks for coming to speak with us today, Gábor.
Well, thanks again. Pleasure to be with you guys.
Yeah, it's an honor for us. Let's drive on. So for, like, myself and Timmy would be so familiar with some of your concepts, but for those who may haven't gone through university or may haven't had the privilege of reading your books and going to the conferences, can you explain to us what trauma is and how trauma is connected to addiction?
Sure. So in all my years in family practice and also in addiction medicine, I found that many chronic physical illnesses, virtually everything that we call mental illness and certainly addictions, are related to childhood trauma. Now, what is trauma? Trauma is the source of the word trauma itself comes from the word Greek for a wound. So trauma is a wound that you sustained. So people often think of trauma as being abused or physically or sexually or emotionally, violence in the family, and so on. And those events are traumatic, but the trauma itself is the wound that the person sustains. And so now, if you want to jump right to addiction, let me give you a definition of addiction, and then you and those of you who are listening can each see how that definition might apply to yourselves. So an addiction can be defined as manifested in any behavior that a person finds temporary pleasure or relief in, and therefore we crave it, but then we suffer long-term negative consequences, and we can't give up despite the negative consequence. So craving pleasure, relief in the short term, negative effects in the long term, inability to give it up. That's what an addiction is. So notice that my definition said nothing about drugs. Usually when we think about addictions, we think in terms of substances, which is fair enough. Mm-hmm. Often they are alcohol, nicotine, heroin, crystal meth, cocaine, whatever. However, people can also be addicted to sex, to gambling, to eating, to shopping, to self-cutting, to bulimia, to gambling, to pornography, to a whole range of human behaviors. Now, I know you guys have both identified yourself as being in recovery from an addiction. Without even me asking you, each of you, Timmy or Tony, what you're addicted to, although you're free to tell us if you want to, what I'm really asking is, what did it do for you in the short term? What did you like about it? That's the first question. So those of you who are listening, just ask yourself the same question. Not what was wrong with the addiction, what was right about it? What did you, in the short term, what did it give you? So what would you guys say about that?
Go on, if Timmy wants to go first, but I'm James. Tony was here, but he's gone.
Go ahead.
For me, addiction gave me a sense of belonging. It gave me comfort, it gave me confidence, self-esteem, you know, all of those things, it gave me things that I didn't have in my normal living, you know, particularly the self-esteem and the confidence, you know, to be able to talk to people. But as you spoke about there also, like in the long term, this addiction destroyed me. My addiction was alcohol.
So let's not go there. Let's just stay with your answer. And James, what would you say?
What was addiction for me? Why I used drugs? Before I used drugs, I would have a lot of fear and anxiety. I didn't understand where I come from. You know, as a teenager, insecurity, self-esteem. Mm. And when I started using substances, it didn't really matter what individual substance was. It relieved me of all that insecurity and fear and anxiety. So that was kind of, I always ran with the drug. It didn't matter what the drug was after that.
Very good. All right. So let's take what you guys have said. Confidence, comfort, sense of belonging, self-esteem, relief of anxiety, relief of insecurity, a sense of security. Are those good things or bad things in themselves?
They were good things because they worked at the time.
Yeah, they're wonderful things. These are things we all human beings want. Now, that means that the addiction, it's nonsense to talk about addiction as a disease, because what kind of a disease gives you security and comfort and self-esteem and belonging? It's also ridiculous to talk about it as a choice, because who chooses to be insecure and anxious and uncomfortable and isolated and emotionally wrought up? So these are all states of emotional pain. And addiction soothes the pain. So that's my mantra under addiction, is not why the addiction, but why the pain. Now, why the pain? You just told me about your childhoods. You told me that as you were growing up, in your family of origins, things happened to you that robbed you of security, that robbed you of genuine self-esteem, that robbed you of comfort, that robbed you of your God-given right to belong to the human race. That robbed you of confidence. So that's the trauma. The trauma is the loss of all these good qualities that every child should have. And so they're the traumatic events, but the trauma then is the wound that we sustain, that we then keep trying to soothe all our lives. And addictions really are a way of soothing the pain induced by early trauma.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because when I was around 17, 18, I had a suicide attempt. And after that, I found benzodiazepines. And even though I was my life was destroyed on benzodiazepines and I was going in and out of prison and hospitals, I wasn't trying to kill myself, you know. So in a kind of a paradoxical way, they helped me get over that part of my life where I was suicidal. Then the drugs helped me through it, even though I was, you know, in and out of prison, but it got me through that point in my life.
There's a lot of people who are driven to the point of despair, and as one very famous writer said to me, drugs saved my life.
Yeah.
Then they almost destroyed me. So but initially the addictions, again, to whatever it is, whether it's drugs or behaviors, it comes along to soothe some kind of a deep pain and deep despair. And the source of that deep pain and deep despair is childhood trauma.
Yeah.
I would have been quite similar to James as well. You know, I would have used substances at a really young age. And I can really relate to what that your friend, that author, said. Because when I look back at my own life in hindsight, if I didn't have those substances or drugs in my life to take me away from what was going on inside my head, and the feelings and emotions that I was going through that I wasn't able to handle, I possibly, looking back now, I don't know what I could say I possibly would have took my own life, because that did come into my mind. But
or you might have turned to violence or something desperate, you know. And so a lot of the people listening, if you're in jail, you're being punished for your behaviors, maybe to do with drugs, maybe to do with violence. But what you're really being punished for is how you were wounded as a child and how you weren't given a help to resolve that wound. I'm not saying that people aren't responsible, and we have to be, but we have to understand, for society to be responsible, it means that we have to understand why people behave the way they do, and particularly why they, say, turn to drugs. I've never met anybody addicted to drugs who woke up out of a happy life one Saturday morning and said, hey, my ambition is to become a drug addict. It wasn't like that. It's that people came across the drug and all of a sudden they felt like they've never felt before in their lives, in a positive sense. You know, so we have to look at the sources of how they were deprived of that positivity earlier in life. And you
doesn't,
know,
it doesn't it?
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, go on. No, I was going to say, doesn't it just emphasize how pointless an exercise is of sending people in addiction in and out of prison for short sentences for possession?
Well, I worked in, I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and in an area called the Downtown East Side, which is really North America's most concentrated area of drug use. I mean, if you walk down into those huge black square blocks, you see people injecting and inhaling and selling, and you know. And those people, it's like a revolving door. They go in and out of jail. Now, we call the prison system the correctional system, but it doesn't correct anything. It's a punitive system. It's not a correctional system. We also talk about rehabilitation, but very few people ever get rehabilitated because the wound, the trauma that keeps driving their behaviors is never healed. It can be, but neither the medical system nor the legal system understands the need to heal the trauma. And so then it's a revolving door, and people do detox in prison willy or nilly, but then they come out and within a couple of days they use it again. That was my experience. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if you're going to lock people up, give them the rehabilitation treatment that they actually need. If you think you need to protect society from certain behaviors, well, that might be fair enough. But why be punitive about it? Why not help people really heal? And that can be done. It doesn't need to be done the way we do it. You can protect society, and you can also help people at the same time. And furthermore, it's a bit arbitrary, isn't it? Because if you like, in most countries, say possessing heroin or cocaine is illegal, but possessing alcohol or cigarettes is not illegal, and alcohol and cigarettes kill a lot more people than heroin or cocaine ever do. I'm not saying cocaine or heroin should be sold in the streets or in the corner stores, but I'm saying that there's a real contradiction about the social attitude towards substances. Some substances that are far more lethal in the long term are permitted and profited off by respectable businessmen. Other drugs are forbidden and people are sent to jail for possessing them. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm. Do you think that Ireland should follow Canada in legalizing cannabis? How do you think that's playing out where you're from?
Well, I think Canada and Ireland should both follow Portugal, where they've actually decriminalized the personal possession of any drug. Nobody goes to jail for possessing drugs in a small quantity for personal use.
Mm.
Crime has gone down, treatment levels have gone up, and there are few people in jail. And there's been no increase in drug use. So it's not that Ireland should follow Canada. Certainly it's nonsense to legalize cannabis. I mean, look, if everybody in Canada, whoever used cannabis, was in jail, half the population would be behind bars. And probably the same thing is true in Ireland. So that was a reasonable step forward, but not nearly far enough.
Yeah, we have a certain type of decriminalisation in here, a very weak form of it, where you get a caution if it's your first two offences. Mm-hmm. No, and it's at the discretion of the judge. But who does that really suit? For the people that you worked with in Vancouver, the people that I worked with in homeless services here in my city, if they got caught with drugs twice in the day, they don't then turn around and say, "Oh, I better stop using drugs now because I'm going to go to court the next time." They don't. But who does it? It does suit. It suits maybe the politician's daughter who's in university and gets caught with some weed when they're out, and they can avoid one or two convictions. So there's a classism to all this as well, isn't there?
Well, absolutely. And besides which, it's a nature of severe drug addiction that you can't just give it up because there's some negative consequence. I mean, look, the people I worked with in Vancouver had HIV, they had hepatitis C, they had abscesses, diseases of all kinds. That wasn't enough to make them give it up. And not because they were stupid, but because they were so desperate and so dependent. And so there's two strikes and you're out kind of nonsense. It makes
ridiculous.
It makes no human or medical sense whatsoever. And really what's missing is that the system is not trauma-informed. And if you look at Ireland, I mean, not that I'm any kind of expert in Irish history, but for God's sakes, you know, hundreds of years of colonialism, hunger, internecine strife, civil war. And then, on top of that, the now well-identified abuse of children, of both of all genders by the clergy. There's been a lot of trauma in your country. Mm. And so no wonder alcoholism and drug use and so on are prevalent as you'd expect them to be. And this is a traumatized society. And therefore, it needs to be trauma-informed.
Yeah. Do you know, for all the things you spoke about in Irish history, the trauma, you could argue for Irish travellers, I don't know if you're aware, but Irish travellers are a separate ethnic group in Ireland, akin to the Aboriginals in your country, where they have, you know, very high rates of suicide, you know, well overrepresented in the prison system. Can you explain a little bit about, you know, how that trauma is kind of passed on through generations and how state policy, you know, impacts upon ethnic groups?
Well, the example you gave, James, of Canada's Indigenous population is a tragic and, I would say, from the point of view of Canadian society, a shameful one. Because the British colonialists, and the French, for that matter, when they came to North America, they, as colonialists always do, they decided that the way to dominate people, if you're going to take over their lands, appropriate their resources, and make them subservient, you have to rob them of their family structure. You have to rob them of their spiritual ways. You have to destroy their traditions. And you have to control them. And so there was the very gradual and very consistent breaking of treaties. The British would sign one treaty after another with the natives and break one after the other when the ink was barely dry on these treaties. They continually encroached on their lands and resources. This continues. And then to take the Indian out of the Indian, as they said, they would destroy the native family structure. Now, here's what I have to tell you, is that the way Aboriginal peoples parent their children is far superior than the way we parent children today in so-called civilized society. And this has been studied and researched. And just the way children are held and loved and they're not hit, and they're with nurturing adults all the time, and they're out there in nature. This is the way you parent if you want healthy human beings. Well, what did they do? They took kids away from their parents for over 100 years, forced them into these residential schools, and this is not unlike stuff, some of what happened in Ireland.
Yeah.
And where, in the name of Christian education, they were beaten and abused, many of them sexually abused. A lot of these kids died. We don't even know where they're buried. And generation after generation of Native children were taken away from their families, so they never learned how to parent. So when they became parents themselves, they enacted the same trauma that was inflicted on them on their kids. So it became multi-generational. So when you look at Native communities today in Canada, and I'm often invited to work with them, high rates of suicide, as you said, substance use, glue sniffing, self-cutting, violence, sexual abuse of children, almost universal sexual exploitation of young girls. And this just continues and continues and continues. And the result is, in Canada, Native people make up 5% of our population. They make up 30% of the jail population.
Sam Hill.
Yeah. You know, for some, I have a question, dear Gabor. It's just relating to somebody, you know, somebody that's in active addiction. And, right, for example, myself, you know, the drugs did so much for me, and the alcohol, they kept me, they just took everything away. You know, I remember the moment in my own life as a really young child, and there was a lot of trauma going on in my own family home. You know, there was a lot of mental health issues, and, you know, there was a single parent, my mother bringing up a few boys on her own. But, like, going on, I remembered a kind of a moment in my life where it was just like, it was a block off point. I just stopped, you know, I just lost all kind of faith in humanity and people and God, all these different things,
yes,
you know. But as I went through my life, then, you know, the drugs and the alcohol, they would have blocked out all my thinking. The only thing I could think about was alcohol, drugs, gambling, and all the other addictions that were in my life, you know. But I met my wife, you know, my kids at the time, and they were the only bit of stability that I had in my life. And I was given an ultimatum at probably the worst point in my life, you know, where a lot of people would probably stop, but I couldn't stop because I wasn't able to stop, number one. And number two, the drugs done so much for me. They took me away from so much pain in my life, you know. But my point is, I had something to fight for. I had a wife. At the time, she wasn't my wife. She was my partner, and I had two young kids. Does somebody really need something in their life to fight for like that, to really give up alcohol and drugs, which would maybe their partner in life, you know? Or can they just... Is it possible, or do they need a good social network around them to be able to get them through it, from your experience?
Well, so first of all, although I've never had a substance addiction personally, I've have had addictive behaviors. And even though I didn't have the substance, I didn't have my cells crying out for the substance like Jews would have. My behavior addiction threatened my marriage. And like probably you did, I lied to my wife. And I ignored the needs of my kids.
Yeah.
That's how important the addiction can become. And to answer your question, we're by nature social creatures. In other words, we're biologically created to be in connection with one another. We evolved in small band hunter-gatherer groups. We didn't evolve as individuals living on a savanna or in a forest by ourselves. So our psychology and our biology, including our brain biology, cries out for connection. As a matter of fact, the substances, like for example heroin, the opiates, they resemble chemicals in our own brain that give us a sense of connection. So, in a very real sense, the biology or the neurobiology, the brain biology of addiction is rooted in our deepest human needs. And when those needs for connection are not met in life, then we'll turn to addictive behaviors or substances. It also means that connections in a social network can give us a reason, a purpose, and a calling to move out of our addictions. But that drive really has to come from within. And, you know, if you look at the 12-step groups, and I have certain issues with the 12-step groups. At the same time, I think the 12 steps are great. So, but what they do provide, don't they, is they give you a community. That's the whole point of them. Is that, look, here we are, and we're not each of us better than the other or worse than the other. We're just here facing the same dilemma. How can we support each other? And the group energy of a collective moving towards a common goal actually lifts up the individuals in that group to a higher level of energy. So whether it's personal relationships or a network that you can join or form, it's so much more easy and possible to do it through connection than to do it in an isolated sense. You know what? I would say, yes, it's when you have something to live for, a relationship, that's great. At the same time, there's also a deep reason within ourselves, which is that true relationship with ourselves. I mean, when you lost connection with yourself and you said that blackout moment, you lost connection with yourself. And that's one of the impacts of trauma, is that you lose connection with yourself. Now, when you recover, if you actually look at the word recovery, what does it mean? To recover means to find something. And what did you find when you recovered? You guys tell me, what did you find when you recovered?
You find yourself. You're on the pathway to finding yourself.
Exactly. And so that's worth it too, even if there's no external relationship.
Yeah. I think in recovery, like in addiction, when I didn't have the drugs, it was that low self-esteem, insecurity. I think what I recovered in recovery, what I found was a self-acceptance and accepting yourself for who you were, flaws and all, and just being able to kind of move forward with that. Right. I think what you spoke about in terms of the community being like, in terms of the 12-step communities, the fellowship and the strength of that. And where I work in Cool Mind Addiction Services in Cork here, we work from a therapeutic community model. And I see that working, you know, just to, that, you know, just when people get around each other and kind of help each other along is great. Like, you know, a lot of our followers would be people not in addiction but may have loved ones in addiction. I'm sure over the years you've had family members come to you asking you what can they do, and we get a lot of family members coming to us, how do I help young Timmy or young James is going down the wrong path, what can I do? Have you any advice for family members?
I do. You know, I have advice for everybody. That's just what I do.
That's why you're here.
not that everybody wants it all the time, but I have it anyway.
Yeah. So we just put it out there anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Well, particularly my own family, let me put it that way. But so I've written a book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, which has been published in the UK, at least, not to mention North America. And there's a whole chapter on families and caregivers. So let me summarize what I say in that chapter. And here's what I would say. It's very painful, it's very difficult, it's very frustrating and heartbreaking to be close to somebody who's addicted and whose path you'd like to influence for the better, but you find yourself powerless to do so. So how can you approach it? There's three ways. Two of them are sane, one of them is insane. Okay? One of the sane ways is to say to the addicted person, look, I'm not trying to change you. I know that right now, and going back to my question, not why the addiction, but why the pain, I know that right now something is driving you to pursue these addictive behaviors. And I imagine that something inside you is some kind of pain. And I understand and I don't judge you, but it's too painful for me to be around. I don't know how to handle my feelings that come up for me. when I see you. I'm not doing this to punish you. I love you. I want to be here for you. But right now I can't be around you because I don't know how to handle the emotions that I get around you. It's not your fault. And you're not doing it to me. But I'm too stressed around it. So that's legitimate. Okay? The second sane thing to do is to say, right now, you're doing what you're doing. You're addictive. You're gambling on your pornography or your drugs or your drinking or whatever you're doing. And I know that you must have some powerful drive inside you to compel you to do that. And I don't know if I understand it, but I know you must be in pain. And this is a way of soothing the pain. And I accept that. And you don't need to be any different for me to love you and be around you. I can be it. I can be with it. I won't put up with being manipulated or lied to or stolen from. But I don't need to interfere in your life. It's your life, not mine. And I can be around you and I'm here for you. That's the second sane way. The insane way is to be in that person's life and try and change them. To try and stop them, cajole them, threaten them, bribe them, beg them to be different. Because that means that you're dependent on them to be different so you can feel better. And that makes you a codependent. And that means you got your own problems. And here's the thing. Here's you guys. Let's try something, okay? Both put your hands up just the way I'm doing it right now. Put your left hand against your right hand. Now push with your right hand against the left hand. Push as hard as you can. Push, push, push. What does the left hand do?
Strength.
Push against.
Pushes right back. And when we push on people to be different, even if we're trying to impel them in the right direction, they're going to push back. All you're going to get back is resistance. And everybody listening to me here has already experienced that. So don't do it. Don't create more don't create more resistance. Invite them or tell them you can't handle it, but don't try and force, cajole, convince, try to influence that other person to be different. Accept them exactly where they're at. Now, there's one more thing I would say to families. Sometimes you hear about these interventions where everybody gets together and tell the addict how difficult it is for them and how much it hurts them and please be different and here's a program and, you know, nonsense. Hardly ever works. Might sometimes, but hardly ever. The studies are not very promising. Here's a kind of intervention that I think would make sense. The family says to the addicted one, you know, we get that you're carrying a lot of pain and you need to do this behavior to soothe that pain. But we also know that that pain didn't start with you. It happened in your family of origin, which is to say, we all contributed to it. Not that we meant to, but somehow we did. To speak personally, and to maybe you might agree with this, I mean, before you healed or recovered, there's no way you wouldn't have passed on some of your trauma onto your kids. And I know that I passed on my trauma to my kids. So trauma is always multi-generational. And it doesn't begin with any one particular person. Nobody should be blamed for it. But at the same time, everybody has to take responsibility for it. So what if the family said, you know, we get that this trauma is multi-generational. It's been in this family system for decades or generations. You happen to be one of the sensitive ones who absorbed a lot of that, and your addiction represents that pain that you absorbed from your environment. It's not our fault, it's not your fault, but we're all responsible. So how about if we all heal together and we invite you to join in that healing process, but we're going to undertake that healing journey whether or not you're ready to join us or not. We invite you to. Now that's the kind of intervention that I love to see happen. You hardly ever do see it, but because it's so painful for families to acknowledge that the source of the addiction individual actually came out of the family multi-generational system and the whole culture. But it did. So we might as well face it. We might as well own up to it, take responsibility. And what if as a society, what if Irish society or Canadian society actually said, you know, you people in jail and you people caught in the throes of addiction are actually manifesting the multi-generational, historical, multi-family trauma that's endemic in our culture. and we're not going to blame you for it. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
The freedom and the sigh of relief that so many people would experience.
How do you get that amount of, how do you put that amount of awareness within a society, you know, because like, you just look at society at the moment, everybody's full of fear over all this COVID stuff and all, whatever. Yeah. But even before that, people were just full of fear, full of fear of not accomplishing enough in their life, not owning their own house and all these different things. Like, you know, how do we actually sit people down and explain to them, if you do this, this may affect your kids growing up. They might become an addict, or they might become very violent, or they will have no social skills, or all these things. You know, it's just a massive question that we have to ask ourselves. How do we actually get this awareness out there so people can really understand that their actions are really something that will follow them down the line with their own kids?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's...
you know, it's
a huge question that you're raising. I'm just writing a new book, which will be published a year from now, next April. It'll be called The Myth of Normal, Illness and Health in an Insane Culture. And the culture is insane because it doesn't meet human needs. Like the fear that you talked about, the work of not accomplishing enough and so on, it's endemic. And when people are in a state of fear, they can't think rationally. And this society is insane because it puts people in a state of fear. So when you look at human needs, the chapter I'm just writing, I made this little list of what human needs are, genuine human needs. They're for a sense of belonging and connectedness. They're for a sense of autonomy or control in one's life. A sense of mastery or competence, that I can do something. Not in comparison with others, but just something that I can feel good about. Genuine self-esteem, which doesn't depend on what others think of me, but it's that self-acceptance that you guys talked about, that I can accept myself and my flaws, that I'm not worthwhile because I can do this, that, or the other. I'm worthwhile whether or not I can do this, that, or the other. Trust that I have the personal and social resources to get through life, and a sense of purpose and meaning and transcendence, that I belong to something greater than just a little egoic mind of mine. These are genuine human needs. This society, gauge for yourself how well it meets those human needs. It doesn't meet them, it tramples on them. No wonder so many people are in trouble. How do we get there? Well, we get there because you guys have this podcast.
Yeah.
And because you're willing to share your experience and your hard-earned wisdom. And because you're not afraid to talk about your own dysfunctions and your own traumas. And because I'm not afraid to talk about mine. Because we use whatever platform I have gained in life and whatever platform you have achieved to educate and to inform and to invite others. It's a process. So I don't have any magic snapping with fingers formula. Mm-hmm. We just have to keep this conversation going. And you know, there's some good news. I'm sure that in Ireland, as it is in North America, this conversation has got far more listening than it would have had 10 years ago. In other words, a lot more people can nod their heads and say, yeah, I get what they're talking about. And some of the best-selling books in North America, you know, are on trauma. So, and my books have been published in nearly 30 languages. So, you know, and by the way, without trying to sell you anything, those of you that have not read my books, and you don't need to, well, you should, but...
You definitely should.
Yeah, but you don't need to. But here's what you can do. You can go on YouTube, if that's available to you, and just put in my name, and you'll see dozens of talks, totally free, and all these subjects, and you can watch them and get a lot of information that way. And I'm not the only one talking about these things. There's others. So that there's a lot of way to get information these days. And so what I'm saying is, how do you do it? By focusing on it, by talking about it. I should actually tell you guys, in a month, a film will come out, a documentary about my work. It's called The Wisdom of Trauma. And if you guys don't have the link, you can contact my manager, who you're in contact with, Stephanie, and she'll send you the link, a trailer, and you can sign up. And that whole week that this film is being shown online, I'll be in conversation with some leading trauma experts, and that's available to anybody who's got YouTube access.
Yeah,
excellent. We'll definitely share that.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying about a growing awareness and interest in all things related to trauma is definitely the case where we're from. You know, when you were over in my city a couple of years ago, my University College Cork, you did a 2-day conference around the same time. Bessel van der Kolk was in another part of the city, and that was sold out as well. So there's huge interest in this, which is the start of the awareness, what Timmy was talking about. But if I can just change direction a small bit, Gabor, I have a family member who has ulcerative colitis, and I have a friend who, another couple of friends that they have lupus and other autoimmune diseases, conditions. Can you explain to us how trauma relates to those chronic illnesses?
Sure. Before I do, you mentioned Bessel. His book, The Body Keeps the Score, is the number 3 best-selling books in the New York Times this week.
Really?
Yes, and it's been on the best-selling books for months. So, I mean, people are really getting it now, the message.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Now, autoimmune disease, like ulcerative colitis and lupus and the whole range. There are two major ways that trauma potentiates those diseases. And in my experience, everybody with autoimmune disease suffered trauma in childhood. Everybody. Not that the doctors will tell you that, because despite all the research literature showing the links, most physicians are not aware of the links. But early childhood trauma actually interferes with how genes are expressed, and they promote the activation of inflammatory genes. And they also cause other changes in the body that I'm not going to go into in detail. But the point is, people traumatized have more inflammation in their bodies, so they're more likely to get inflammatory diseases. Number one. Number two, on a physiological level, trauma creates a lot of physiological stress, which exhausts the body's own stress mechanisms. Now, how do we treat these conditions, colitis and lupus? You know how we treat them? With stress hormones. Because their own body's stress hormones get depleted from overactivation. And that's the funny thing about doctors, like in my own training as a physician. We treat everything with stress hormones, but never ask ourselves, gosh, does this condition may have something to do with stress? Like cortisol is a stress hormone. And that's what everybody gets with lupus and colitis and rheumatoid arthritis and a whole range of conditions. So that's the second pathway. The third pathway is the early trauma creates certain personality patterns. Now, people with autoimmune disease, and I can tell you, I don't know your relatives or friends with lupus or colitis, but I can tell you about their personalities. They have no idea how to experience healthy anger. They repress their anger. They have no idea how to take care of their own needs. They tend to take care of the emotional needs of others ahead of their own. They're driven by duty and responsibility rather than needs of the self. So these personality patterns, and I talk about this in my book, When the Body Says No, because they don't know how to say no. So the body says no in the form of illness. It also follows that when they learn how to say no, the body doesn't have to keep saying it. So I've known people, lots of people with autoimmune disease who got better once they changed their relationship to themselves. Problem is, when you go to the average physician trained like me in the Western medical model, you can go in there with your inflammation in your intestines or in your skin or in your lungs or in your connective tissues. And nobody's going to ask you, what happened to you as a child? Nobody's going to ask you, how do you feel about yourself? Nobody's going to ask you, how much stress is there in your life? They're not going to ask you these questions, but they're pertinent. They're pertinent to who develops illness and who doesn't. So the connection is both physiological and psychological, in the sense that certain personality patterns are promoted by trauma, and those patterns create more stress as you go along. And that stress then leads to the immune system turning against yourself. So there's lots of ways in which trauma. Now, people who are, Canadian studies show that men who were sexually abused as children had 50% increase in the risk of cancer. This is regardless of whether or not they smoked or drank. And again, people who are traumatized, lots of studies have shown they're at elevated risk for mental health conditions, autoimmune disease, ADHD, depression, malignancy, and so on, for perfectly straightforward reasons.
Mm. Do you know, when you were over in Cork here, Gabor, you spoke about, you gave examples of obituaries in newspapers.
Yeah.
Where, for example, and just an example, say my obituary, touchwood, I have a few years left, but just say my obituary, James was a good man. He always kept his head down, never missed a day's work. He would never say no to help others. And then you turned around and you says, James never looked after himself. Yeah. Can you explain to us the importance of self-care, especially for those in the helping professions?
Well, a lot of people that go into the helping professions, they do it for two sets of reasons. One set of reasons is because they're genuinely empathic, compassionate people who want to help humanity. Good. But there's also a drive to be important. Mm-hmm. And that drive to be important, if it depends on something external, is never satisfied. So one of my addictions was to work. Now, if you're a workaholic doctor, you know what happens? The world loves you. You make more money and you get all this accolades and all this admiration. Oh, he's always available. He's, you know, he's so selfless and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you're stressing yourself like crazy because you don't know how to say no. And your family is suffering. And I have back pain and I have depression. I'm talking about myself. I don't even know why. Why do I have back pain? Because I'm carrying too much on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. Why do I have depression? Because I'm pushing myself down. I'm pushing down my own needs. So self-care, healthcare workers are prone to that. So the thing is, yes, we need to care for others. That's where our commitment and our calling is. But that others have to include ourselves as well. We can't divide into two sets of people. Everybody else who deserves help and care, and the one person, myself, who doesn't. That's a sure way to burn out.
Yeah.
And so self-care, that's one reason why self-care is important. But the other reason is that everybody who comes to you for help in the healthcare world, pretty much everybody, not everybody, the vast majority of people have been traumatized, stressed people. If you really want to be able to help them, deal with your own stress. So you're coming from a grounded, calm, peaceful place. That's going to make all the difference to your capacity to help these others. So even if you want to do your job better, you have to say no sometimes to the job and yes to yourself, and that means you'll do a better job in what you do.
Can I just bring you back a little bit there? We spoke about the 12 steps. I don't know, we're going away from what we're talking about now, but it's just related to doing the program of the 12 steps, Gabor, right? I went through the steps twice, once in prison and once when I came out, you know.
Yes.
But, and I also seen a psychologist in the prison and a psychotherapist outside, and I done loads and loads of work on myself, and I started to learn about why I felt the way I did about myself, why I felt bad, no good, worthless, and all these different things. But I always still felt the same. I still had that feeling of worthlessness within me, you know.
Yeah.
But what I done then was I meditated a lot, an awful lot, and the meditation really, I was able to free that trapped energy that was caught within me, you know, down in my lower centers, you know, my first and second set, just really trapped in the body. Mm-hmm. Now, it's still there, you know, it's still there, like I carry an awful lot of shame within me, and that's hereditary. It's from passed on from my mother, who carried it when in her own life, you know. But you know, what are your thoughts on the route of meditation for really kind of helping people to free up that pain that working with psychologists and psychotherapists therapist doesn't really do, because that's what happened for me. I learned so much from the psychologist and the psychotherapist, but I still didn't feel better about me as myself, you know. But the meditation really freed that up a little bit for me. What are your thoughts on meditation around all that?
Okay, well, first of all, you said the feeling of worthlessness.
Mm-hmm. No,
that's not a feeling. Okay? It's a belief.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a belief. And itself, it's a trauma response.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, in my new book, I talk about this. It's a bit difficult to explain, but let me try. That belief that you're worthless actually is your friend, I'm going to say. And you say, how the heck can that be my friend? It blights my life. Think about it this way. You're the child growing up under the circumstances that you're growing up on. And I don't know what happened, but there's going to be dysfunction, distress. Your parents are completely unable to meet your needs for acceptance and belonging and valuation. Now, as a child, you have two alternatives. You can believe that your parents are bad or incompetent and that the world is just a dangerous, awful place. And you're totally alone in the universe. That's one. You can believe that. Or you can believe that I'm worthless. And maybe if I work hard enough, I can earn my right to exist. Now, which is safer for the child to believe?
Yeah.
Which is?
Second one.
Second one.
For me, yeah.
That's exactly it. So that sense of worthlessness saved your bacon. It saved your life. Yeah. So first of all, you shouldn't see it as an enemy. It was your friend. Problem is, it's a stupid friend. When I say stupid friend, it doesn't learn. It doesn't know that it's no longer needed. And that's the problem with these trauma-induced beliefs, is that they save our lives or they save our sanity as children, but then become millstones on our neck later on. So first of all, I'm suggesting to you that when you notice that sense of worthlessness, make friends with it.
Mm.
Say to it, hello again. I see you. Thank you. You were very helpful to me when I was 5 years old. I don't need your services anymore. But I don't need you to go away. I'll just be with you. Now, meditation can help you. First of all, do you get what I mean?
I understand 1,000,000%. Yeah.
Okay, great. Then in meditation, which gives you some distance from the busy mind, when you notice that worthlessness coming up, just notice it. Neither reject it nor believe it. Oh, there it is again. So meditation gives you this distance from the contents of your mind. So it's a very powerful technique for those that can do it.
Yeah, it takes some time, doesn't it?
I'm the world's, you know, in one of my books, I talk about how I have a profound relationship with meditation. I think about it every day, you know, but actually trying to get me to do it.
I can relate with that.
Yeah.
But you know what? Study after study shows what a beneficial modality is. And the benefit is actually in strengthening the capacity of your brain to be aware of things without being identified with them. So that belief of worthlessness. Now, there's a feeling that comes along with the belief in worthlessness. That feeling is shame.
Yeah, that's you know what? It's the shame.
Yeah.
It is the shame, and I'm really starting to work on that myself a little bit more. And I think you brought it up earlier there about Ireland as a country. We're carrying so much shame as a country in a whole, you know, shame because of all this stuff that would have happened in the past.
Well, not only that, you know, it's not only that. Look, I read James Joyce's Portrait of a Young Man as an Artist, and he talks about, as a school, you know, the chief character is a schoolboy goes to church and he listens to the sermon, which is about the sin inherent in the human soul and about how you're going to go to hell. And he talks about eternity. And the priest in the book talks about eternity. If you imagine the earth as a big metal ball, and every million years a dove comes and gently touches the earth with his wings as he flies by, then eventually, with his wing, he would wear the earth away over billions and billions of billions of years. But, says the priest, hell will never be worn away. It's much more eternal than that. Now, this is the kind of stuff that kids are brought up in. This is the kind of fear that they're brought up with. They're made to feel, and so many religions, which at their core bring a message of love and peace, in their practice, in their institutionalized form, inflict shame on people. And shame, if you want to control people, you know what you do? You make them feel ashamed.
Yeah.
So not only is the problem of trauma, there's also the culturally induced shame. It's a big one. It's a huge one to overcome. By the way, I'm Jewish, and there's a joke about, you know what Jewish Alzheimer is? Jewish Alzheimer's disease? You forget everything but the guilt, you know? and I would say the same thing of Catholic Alzheimer's, you know? You forget you forget everything but the shame and the guilt. No, I don't want to make fun of a serious illness, but this idea that guilt and shame are inflicted on young kids for reasons that have nothing to do with their needs or their real lives, you know?
Yeah.
As a way of control. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, we won't keep you much longer, but I've one more question, and then I leave Timmy finish up with a question. But I'm interested in drug policies. You know, that was my thesis topic. In my experience of working with people in homelessness, and you would have had similar experience, some people may never get recovery, you know, and some people, they'll maybe reducing the use is about as good as it'll get. In England recently, in Middlesbrough, I think it was, in the northwest of England, they trialled a heroin-assisted treatment where the GP prescribed heroin to those that all other forms of treatment have not worked. And it's seen that person reduced crime, no transmission of blood-borne infections, no overdoses. They were able to get employment and just raise their quality of life. It's not abstinence, but it's still a lot better than where they were. And it's a cost-effective approach. Would you be an advocate of that as a physician and as somebody who's worked in homeless services as well?
Well, here's the frustrating thing, is that they used to do this in England decades ago.
Yeah.
With the same results. And then they kind of stopped it. Or they cut down on it. This has been done in Switzerland, in Holland, in Canada. In Vancouver, I worked at such a facility. The results are overwhelmingly and uniformly positive in terms of overdose prevention, disease transmission prevention, employability, family life, self-esteem. It's not a scientific issue. The science has been resolved a long time ago. It's a political issue. It's a drug policy issue, as you say. So it's all a question of what is the intent of drug policy. If the intent of drug policy is to reduce illness, to rehabilitate people, and by the way, even when you say some people won't give up their addiction, that's partly because the system is not in place to help them heal. What if there was a whole system to help them heal? A lot more people would give up their addictions, I believe. So it's not just because they're addicted, it's because they don't get the help they need. But even assuming that some people can't give up their addictions no matter what, well, then what you're suggesting has been over and over again, overwhelmingly, and without any contradiction, proven to be beneficial. So if we're not doing it, it's not for lack of proof. It's out of prejudice and a kind of perverse, punitive, uninformed attitude. What can you say about it? It makes no sense. And, you know, I'm sure it is frustrating for you, just as it is for me, knowing that there's so much we can do, so much that has been proven to work, and we're just not doing it. And the politicians, you know, maybe I'll finish on this note. I was once invited to speak to a subcommittee of the Canadian Senate on drug policy. So I flew to Ottawa, and these senators listened, and I noticed with some of them, what I was saying wasn't going in one ear and out the other. It wasn't even going in one ear. They just didn't know how to, I was giving them all this information on trauma, addiction, and so on, everything. You know. And finally I said to them, look, senators, as a physician, you expect me to practice evidence-based medicine. How about you start practicing evidence-based politics? How about if politicians are going to enact drug laws and drug policies, they look at the evidence first? Well, I like to live to see the day when that happens universally.
Yeah, it's very disheartening as a researcher to produce some evidence at that the government will continually ignore to suit, their own ideologies and biases. It's very frustrating. I'm sure it's frustrating for you as a physician with all your experience, expertise and knowledge to be, have a policy that goes against everything that you know and believe to be true, So I let Timmy have the last question.
Okay, sorry, anyway, you can both probably hear the dog barking there for the last 5 minutes, so...
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, my last... this is question really would be for anybody that's listening that's caught up in addiction, as is at the present, what would be the best bit of advice that you could possibly give somebody from your own experience working with people in addiction and recovery and stuff? For what would be the best bit of advice you possibly give him, Gabor? I don't know, it's just probably a mad question, but some people are really, really struggling and they watch your podcast for some form of inspiration. So if there's anything that you could really add to that.
Okay, well, what I would say to them is there's a part of you that actually cares about you. There's a part of you believes that you can heal. And there's a part of you that believes that you deserve to heal. And if none of that was true, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. You wouldn't be listening to this inspiration. In other words, the guidance is inside you. So pay attention to that guidance. The drugs have silenced that voice. Your trauma have attenuated that voice, weakened it, but it's in you and it's the real you. That's what you're going to recover. So there's lots of ways to recover. I'm not here to recommend modalities. Again, I do recommend my talks on addiction on YouTube or my book on addiction as some support for you. But the real support, the real guidance is within yourself. And reach out to others. Don't try to do it on your own. That's the best advice I can give.
Thank you very much. That was great.
Yeah, look, it's brought us to a natural end. We won't keep you much longer. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. It's been a real honour for myself and Timmy, and I'm sure the people watching will have taken a lot from it. You make complex ideas very accessible for people, so it's much appreciated. We'll link all your books and your YouTube talks in the description of the video. And I'm really looking forward to the book coming out and the documentary you spoke about as well. And please God, when we return to normal, it'll be an honour to meet you in person someday. But until then, thank you very much. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.